He was a Mongol ruler, much more in the manner of his granddad, Genghis Khan. He was rather modest in his appearance and his manners. He was accessible and affable. He was supported by three very capable brothers, and those four brothers, until Munkhe's death, and the youngest one precipitated a civil war. But those four brothers generally operated very well as a unit. Mom made sure of that. In addition, Munkhe was committed to new expansion. Expansion was necessary to sustain the monarchy. It was important to providing the booty, the silk, the captives that were so important in winning followers. And so he carried out important changes in the military. He purged the officer corps of those people who had been previously loyal to the house of Ogadai, replaced them with loyal men. In this way, he was following very much the policy of his granddad, Genghis Khan. And by the second or third year of his reign, he was ready to go. Batu, the cousin out on the western steppes, was essentially confirmed in his position as ruler of the Mongols and Turks of the far west. And that Ulus eventually evolved into the Golden Horde. And Batu did very well. He transmitted his position to his younger brother, Berke, and those Khans ruling in the western steppes eventually evolved into independent rulers. They would adopt Turkish and eventually adopt Islam, and they would go their separate way. The family of Jagatai was rewarded with control of the central steppes. The various sons of Jagatai would rule these regions, although they had covetous eyes for Transoxiana and the cities of the Tarim Basin. And there would always be a dispute whether the Jagatayid, that is the descendants of Jagatai, the Jagatayid Khans had claim over those two key urban areas. The really important commissions were given to the two younger brothers of the new Khan. Kublai Khan was commissioned with the eastern steppes and was given the commission to conquer China. We'll get into that in the next lecture. And Hulagu, the second brother, was told, return to the Islamic world, put some kind of order in those conquests, and also take out any opposition to Mongol control of the eastern lands of Islam. And Munkhe had very, very good reason to do this. For one, the Abbasid caliph in Baghdad represented a counter-authority. And the Mongols always weren't quite sure what the caliph's authority was. He looked sort of like a weird Chinese emperor, the son of heaven. They had the same problem with the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. They never quite understood what the arrangement was between the Pope and particularly Frederick II. And in fact, most Western Europeans didn't know what the arrangement was between Frederick II and the papacy. In any case, that was a possible authority, a counter-authority. The other was the rising Mamluk sultans of Egypt, who depended on Turkish slave soldiers that were actually sold from the steppes into service and transported complements of Venice to Cairo, so that the Mamluk sultans, which means the slave soldier sultans, had an excellent army. And above all, this secretive group, this extreme Shiite group, led by a grandmaster living in Alamut, that great fortress in the Elburz Mountains, and with cells across the Islamic world known as the Assassins, popularly. That was their popular name. They're better known as Ishmaelites. Well, they had sent out hit squads to take out Mongol governors. There's apparently one reputedly that was sent after Munkhe. And these guys all had to be removed in the mind of the great Khan and his brothers. And so Hulagu was given the bulk of the field army. It was now transferred from the western steppes to the central steppes to invade the Islamic world. It was perhaps the most impressive campaign since Genghis Khan. Hulagu had an enormous army. Estimates run from 80,000 to 200,000. Clearly, when that army moved across the Eurasian steppes and it left from Karakorum in 1253, it didn't reach Samarkand until 1255. It was a display of Mongol power that had never been seen before. And that army swept into Iran, crossing the Oxus near the city of Merv, one of the few cities that had not been trashed in the earlier campaigns. it had been smart enough to surrender immediately, and began to move across northern Iran. And in 1257, most of the fortresses of the assassins had fallen. The last grand master at Alamut, who was a young boy and really didn't have any stomach for this, he just surrendered the fortress on terms and allowed the Mongols to operate it, occupy it. And the Mongols went through these fortresses, burning various libraries, because the assassins were seen as a political danger. Scholars wonder how much damage was done by this particular act of destruction, because the assassins kept large libraries on all sorts of information, particularly about their political opponents, and that meant this was an inestimable loss for later scholars and future generations. Nonetheless, most of the Muslims, and at least the Sunni Muslims, applauded the destruction of the assassins, who were regarded as political terrorists. And by 12, in the campaigns of 1256, 1257, Iran was secured. The assassins were eliminated. That meant Hulagu was ready to move against the next opponent, and that was the Caliph of Baghdad. Now, for this operation, Hulagu needed reinforcements. He needed local allies. And local forces were provided particularly by some of the Eastern Christian client rulers. This included the king of Cilician Armenia, King Hethum, who compromised his kingdom later with the Muslims, Bohemond VI, the prince of Antioch. These two Christian states sent forces, and they fought with the Mongols down to 1260. The rest of the Christian princes of Outremer were far less eager to get involved in this struggle and more or less sat on the sidelines. Now, the target was Baghdad, and there was the usual exchange of envoys. The caliph simply dismissed the Mongols. I am the caliph of the Islamic world, and Sunni Islam will rally to me. That was a mistake. And the result was war was declared, and Hulagu planned a very, very ambitious campaign. He timed his invasion early in the year 1258. And in January 1258, Mongol columns moved out of the grasslands of Azerbaijan. They avoided the heat of the summer, and they converged on Baghdad. They ravaged the lands. They drove the population into the city. Clearly, the city was swollen with numerous refugees. The reports are that 800,000 would eventually be slaughtered. Hulagu also had with him expert Chinese engineers, as well as all sorts of allied kingdoms. And they were able, in early February, to move their artillery up to the walls of Baghdad and begin pounding the walls. It was clear that the mud brick walls were not going to hold up to Chinese engineers. Their artillery was just too formidable. And on February 10th, the caliph, al-Mustasim, decided to negotiate. He negotiated a surrender, and the terms are unclear. But because he had defied the Mongols initially, when the Mongols actually occupied the city some 3 days later, Hulagu's attitude is, well, all bets are off. You still had defied us. And he allowed the Mongol army to sack the city thoroughly. That sack, which we used as the opening of this course, was seen by many in the Islamic world and even beyond the Islamic world as perhaps the height of Mongol atrocities. The caliph, of course, watched his own family be destroyed, humiliated, and executed. These citizens were marched out on the plain of Iraq. The men, women, and children were ceremoniously beheaded. Piles of skulls were seen on the plains. The bodies were still, and the bones were still to be seen years later. The only people to escape destruction were the Nestorian Christians, a small community, because Hulagu himself was married to a Nestorian wife, although he himself believed in the ancient gods of the Mongols, Tengri, the god of the sky, consulted shamans. According to the accounts, the Tigris ran first black with ink. So many manuscripts were tossed in the Tigris and destroyed as wanton acts of destruction that the libraries were essentially gone. mosques, madrasas, the hospitals, the markets that sustain these Islamic institutions, they were all thoroughly ransacked and then destroyed. Then the Tigris ran red with blood as the population was herded out and slaughtered. We do believe that craftsmen, particularly good-looking girls and boys, and some experts were saved and deported to be used at the Mongol court back in the homeland. But on the whole, it was a pretty thorough and shocking destruction of a civilian population. And Baghdad was a city on a whole other order in size from the caravan cities such as Samarkand and Bukhara. It's still not known whether Hulagu was influenced by his Nestorian wife or perhaps by his favorite general, Kitbukha, who was also known to be a Nestorian and no friend of Islam. But the action was seen as a deliberate and savage act of terrorism, and this atrocity sent shockwaves through the Islamic world. The destruction of Baghdad gave Hulagu control of the religious and political and commercial center of Eastern Islam. It also destroyed the authority of Sunni Islam, because only the caliph could give a firman which would give legitimacy to the various rulers of the Islamic world. So this sack of the city was a religious and political disaster as much as a demographic and economic disaster. In 1259, after retiring to Azerbaijan during the winter and refitting his army, in 1259, the next year after the capture of Baghdad, Hulagu launched a new campaign and swept across the region that we call the Al Jazeera. The Al Jazeera are the grasslands between the upper Euphrates and Tigris. They've traditionally been home to nomads. At this time, there were many Turkish speakers and Arab speakers who practiced a nomadic life. And it was also an area dotted with caravan cities ruled by petty emirs, Abuyid emirs, that is, members of the family of the great conqueror Saladin. The Mongol army made short work. They sacked a number of famous cities, particularly the city of Harran, which it was noted for its ancient mosque going back to the Umayyad caliphs. The city never recovered. It's still in ruins. One emir by the name of El Kamil was seized and tortured brutally. He was forced to eat his own flesh. There were other acts of atrocity committed at the Syrian cities of Aleppo, lesser Syrian cities, in the Orontes Valley. Damascus simply surrendered. They were not about to take on the Mongol army. And Kitbukha actually sent lead elements as far south as Gaza. The Mongol army had reached the Mediterranean shores. At that point, it looked like there was no stopping the Mongols. Except, again, Hulagu had run into the end of his logistical line to invade Egypt. He would need a fleet. He would need cooperation of Venice and the Crusaders. He would need all sorts of new logistics. And while he was planning his next move, he received news that on August 11th, 1259, Mönke had died, and that his younger brother, Berke, was elected the new Khan. That information meant that Hulagu had to suspend operations, retire to Azerbaijan, and wait upon events. He left a small force to secure his western frontier. This force comprised of largely Turkish elements. It also had some Christian allies, notably Armenians and Christian knights from the Principality of Antioch. And this force was entrusted to the senior commander, Kitbukha, and he was given the go-ahead to consolidate this area. Meanwhile, in Cairo, the Sultan of Cairo was not slack. He was putting together forces and ready to intervene and defeat that Mongol force that was stationed in the Bekaa Valley, very close to the ancient city of Baalbek, Heliopolis. And Qutuz, who was then the Mamluk Sultan, and the Sultan was chosen by a consortium of various emirs, that is, slave soldier commanders. He put together an army. He swiftly crossed the Sinai. He got a benevolent neutrality out of the Crusader princes, and in early September, his army reached the Galilee at the location of Anjalut. At Anjalut, the Mamluk army set up positions, and the Mongol army moved out of the Lebanon, out of the Bekaa Valley, and took the bait of a major battle. On September 3rd, the two armies agreed to fight. The real architect of victory was not the Sultan, but his leading emir, Baibar, who went on to overthrow his master, and Baibars set up a battle line which lured the Mongol cavalry to attack in the center, drew them up a hill, and then sprang a trap, a concealment on the flanks, and the Mongol army went down fighting. And again, most of these were Turks and allies, not really a full imperial Mongol forces. Nonetheless, the Mongols had been defeated in an open battle for the first time. Sultan Qutuz got the credit and then was immediately done in by his leading emir, and Baibars became the new sultan. And the Mamluk army actually briefly reoccupied Baghdad, found a supposed member of the old Abbasid family, brought him back to Cairo, and claimed that the caliphate had been restored. And Cairo henceforth emerges as the new power of the Islamic world. Compliments of Baibars and his success at the Battle of Anjalut. This battle marked the end of Mongol power in the West, in the Islamic world, and it revealed the same weaknesses we saw in Central Europe. And Kublai Khan, who would succeed eventually as Great Khan of the Mongol Empire, faced the same problems when he had undertook his conquest of China. But in his case, he solved those problems and pulled off the unthinkable, a nomadic conquest of the ancient Middle Kingdom.
Lecture 31, Conquest of Sung China.
In this lecture, I want to deal with the last of the great Mongol conquests, and that is the conquest of Sung China. This was largely the achievement of Kublai Khan. Some scholars would argue it is perhaps the greatest of the Mongol military achievements. Sung China posed logistical and political and military problems that could have stumped the Mongol army, which is basically a steppe army based on horse archers. To conquer China, Kublai Khan literally had to invent a new army. It is also a major question why Kublai Khan, and actually his predecessor, his elder brother, Mengke, decided to depart with the policy of the earlier Khans and actually take on the Sung Chinese Empire. Genghis Khan, for all of his successes, was really rather traditional in his dealings vis-a-vis the Sung court. At his death in 1227, Genghis Khan had achieved most of what he wanted territorially. The conquests of the Islamic lands in Iran and Transoxiana was arguably something of a fluke. It wasn't intended. He was drawn into it by border conflicts, by the proud and haughty exchanges with Muhammad Shah. But otherwise, Genghis Khan had achieved pretty much what most steppe conquerors would want. He had the central and eastern steppes unified under his sole authority. He had at his disposal something like 150,000, maybe 200,000 nomadic cavalry, Turks and Mongols. He also controlled those key border areas vis-a-vis the Chinese Empire, the rich cities of the Tarim Basin, largely populated by Uyghur speakers now, who provided his ministers, his translators, his interpreters. He controlled the Gansu Corridor that linked those cities to northern China. He controlled most of northern China. He did not control the lower Yellow River Valley, nor the peninsula of Shandong. That was still in the hands of the Jin emperors. But otherwise, he had pretty much what he needed. And his attitude towards the Sung court would also be traditional. You exchange embassies. Perhaps you could extort gifts and tribute. You would get recognition that you were deserving of an imperial marriage. In this sense, Genghis Khan, vis-a-vis Sung China, was probably quite traditional in his policies. He did intend to conquer what was left of the Jin Empire. He had to do that. The city of Kaifeng was targeted, and it was really left to his son, Ogadai, to complete that conquest in 1234, 1235. But otherwise, the Sung court could probably rest at ease that the Mongols posed no immediate threat. Ogadai, of course, fell heir to the campaign against the Jin. Genghis Khan had actually planned a campaign before he died in August 1227. There was the usual delay over the election. It wasn't until 1229. And actually, Ogadai went out of his way to contact the Sung court and agree to a partition of the former Sung domains. This was also in keeping with previous policies. You remember how the Sung court had approached the Jurchens, who had overthrown the Khitan or Liao empress, and also agreed to some kind of partition between northern and southern China. And Ogadai was quite content to knock out the Jin, occupy Kaifeng, and leave it at that. It was the Sung court that attempted to take back Kaifeng. That was the Emperor Li Zong's policy. The Chinese army was driven back. That provoked retaliatory raids into the western frontiers of China, into the region that would be known as Xichao. There were acrimonious exchanges of embassies. But in part, Ogadai was responding to this Sung posturing that those cities of the lower Yellow River Valley really belong to China. They're really part of China. And whatever agreements that were made to take out the Jin were vitiated by the Sung sense that we have to gather all of the Han people back under our control. Even so, Ogadai did not decide to follow up with this. He had no intentions of waging a war against Sung China. His interests were west. He was sending most of his army west with his nephew Batu, who could carry out the conquest of the western steppes in Russia. So the Sung court, which has sometimes been criticized, particularly the emperor Ningzong, who had had close dealings with Genghis Khan and his various successors, they've been criticized for not taking stronger measures against the Mongols. But really, from the Sung viewpoint, the Mongols didn't offer all that much a threat. They were far away, they were remote, and furthermore, the Sung had very, very good reasons to trust to their army and to their traditional defensive strategy. To be sure, they were not able to take back the northern regions. They were frustrated in 1235 by that. Their army could not penetrate and drive out the Mongols. On the other hand, the Mongols were not in much of a position to invade south into the Yangtze or the Yangtze River Valley and take on the Sung fortifications. Furthermore, the emperors of the Sung dynasty may not have commanded armies on the battlefield. They were not in the manner of the great Tang emperors, but they were served by able generals and able bureaucrats. And one aspect about the Sung examination system and the Confucian state that was constructed in the 10th century is those Mandarin bureaucrats had a real sense of loyalty to the throne. And sure, they may have been bureaucrats and they may not have been soldiers by training, but they understood statecraft. They had read the Chinese classics on statecraft, on strategy, on wider diplomatic policy, and they had a very, very good sense of the steppes, and they had a long tradition of previous emperors, Han and Tang particularly, in manipulating the tribes. So every time there was a succession crisis in the Mongol Empire, such as in 1242, or again in 1248, and above all during the Civil War that resulted in the suspension of operations against the Sung in 1259 to 1263, the Sung court could probably rest assured that this Mongol confederation would break up and go away as many previous Mongol confederations had. From the Mongol viewpoint, conquering the Sung Empire was an awesome and daunting task. And it really required a dynamic and energetic Khan to conduct this. Neither Ogodai or Güyük, in my opinion, had the personality and the training to do it. But Münke and Kublai Khan, they did. Münke is confirmed as Khan in 1251 after the usual maneuvering, and he appoints his brother Kublai Khan as master of the Eastern armies. The youngest brother, the fourth one in the group, Ara Berke, is given the kind of nominal control of the heartland, and he talks to the shamans and hangs out at Karakorum. That's actually an important position because it allows him to mass an important political support. But it's clear that Münke had Kublai Khan designated with the commission, go south, while the other brother, the second brother, Hulagu, went west into the Islamic world. Kublai Khan was ideally suited for this task. He had not had much training in the Western domains. He did not serve in Batu's army, for instance. Münke did. So he had very little experience with, Cumans and Russians and Kipchak Turks. He knew very little about the Islamic world, but he did know a great deal about the Mongolian homeland and, above all, about the Mongolian domains in northern China. In some ways, Kublai Khan, more than any other of those four brothers, appreciated the importance of China, and that will become evident in the Civil War and then in the way how he conducts his own conquest when he is Khan and reopens that war carries out the final conquest of the Song Empire. He clearly was brave. He had all of the qualities of a great Khan. There were stories at how Genghis Khan admired this grandson, particularly on the return march from Khorasan. Kublai Khan excelled in hunting and horsemanship. So did Münke. And the two brothers, and those would be the first and third brother in the set of four, were unusually close. Münke knew that Kublai Khan had the smarts to develop the logistics and strategy to undertake the conquest of China. The war opened up with actually operations that were peripheral to the conquest of China, and that was to secure the Western approaches to the Song Empire. They eventually become the southern frontiers of the Mongol Empire. In 1258, Kublai Khan leads an expedition over 650 miles across the rugged terrain of Tibet into the current province of Yunnan in southwestern China, which was then an independent kingdom with its capital city at Dali. And these were non-Chinese people who had converted to Buddhism and were ruled by a sort of Chinese-style monarchy. They're known as the Bai people. This campaign was significant, largely because it was a war of sieges and logistics. Kublai Khan perfected the logistical system to provide the fodder, the water, the food to support a cavalry army in a landscape that was really quite inhospitable to the type of nomadic warfare that was the hallmark of Mongol armies. Kublai also recruited many more Chinese infantry. Now, they always used Chinese engineers. From the very start, they understood that these guys can knock down walls and take cities. But Kublai Khan realized already, and I shouldn't call him Kublai Khan, he's still Kublai, he isn't the great Khan, but Kublai recognized the need to have Chinese infantry in large numbers. They could take cities, they could garrison cities, and